Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
I had one client who became a total convert, and he said to me one day, he's like, Dina, he's like, emotions are money. And I was like, bingo, right?
Yeah.
They are.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. Emotions. When I say that word, what's coming up for you? How you feeling? If your eyes are rolling, if you believe that emotions are soft, that they lead to bad decision-making, or they have no place at work, I'm here to tell you, ignore your emotions at your peril. Hard truth. A better understanding and management of your emotions is the skill you need at work because it leads to hard results. You'll be more effective, increase your performance, reduce burnout, and elevate your leadership. But I say all that very humbly because of the writing and work of an expert who is with me today, Dina Denham Smith. Dina is the author of the best-selling book, Emotionally Charged: How to Lead in the New World of Work. It is evidence-based, updating and correcting the record for us on the science of emotions, but is immensely practical. Practical, I say this for everyone out there, get a copy. Frameworks, scripts, techniques that you can put in practice, use, and improve your emotional management. Dina Smith is an executive coach and strategic advisor who helps senior leaders build their capacity, scale their impact, and thrive in complexity. Lots of credentials. Prior to executive coaching, she served as an EVP in a private equity firm and their affiliated portfolio company, led a 75-plus person organization in the digital marketing world, and started her career as a management consultant at PwC. She holds an MS in Industrial Organizational Psychology and an MBA, high distinction, from the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Prolific thought leader, she's written more than 60 publications, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, you name it, and her book, Emotionally Charged. Dina, welcome to 97% Effective. Great to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for that very lovely, lovely introduction. I think you really like just spelled out my book. I'm not sure what else I need to do here today.
Oh, no, we're going to talk about it. We're going to unpack parts. People do need to read it because we would not do that justice. I like to start with just kind of one thing. And like I said, you are very prolific. You have been interviewed a lot. There's a lot about you on the internet, some of which I may bring in here. Could you share one important thing about you that we wouldn't find about you on the internet?
Yeah, you would need to dig deep to find this. But I had the very singular experience of growing up on the campus of an all-boys boarding school. So both my parents were teachers, and I was what was known as a faculty brat. And I was one of about three girls my age, with a ratio of about 150 teenage boys at any given point in time. And it shaped a lot of how I see and experience the world, no doubt about it.
How did it shape and inform your world? Because you went into management consulting, you were in PE firms, you were down there in Texas, you were from the Northeast. We have certain images of Texas.
Well, I can't imagine better training for the corporate world than that.
And that leads me to all those things I said at the beginning of what we perceive about emotions. It's soft. It has no place. Suppress it. Put your game face on. These are things you talk about in your book. But if you were to go back and work with the younger Dina who's entering that, let's just be frank, right? It's a masculine corporate world back then. How would Dina have reacted to the book, or what would have been one thing that would have really benefited her?
The whole book would have benefited me. I was like an Olympic level compartmentalizer. Mm. I'm not sure about you, but I did not grow up with a family where we, you know, sat around the dining room table and talked about our feelings. We talked about like, what'd you get done today? Right? Like, what have you won or accomplished? And so I had the very misguided notion early on that acknowledging or expressing my emotions might get in the way of my goals. And I had big goals and a high drive for achievement. And so really understanding the science sooner rather than later could have benefited me immensely.
Mm. So that begs the question, when did you start to, these emotions are useful, interesting things that do need my attention? Clearly, you were on an upward slope. You achieved a lot. And I suppose this also goes into then why you wrote your book, why you dove into and wanted to write a book about emotions. When was the change? What caused that?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in what shapes human behavior. And so, gosh, I can't even pin a date on it, but maybe 15 years ago, I started to get really intrigued by emotions and just their impact on behavior and the science behind emotions. But where it really became such a focus for me was early on in the pandemic. I had this just front row seat to the shifts in the workplace by coaching leaders and coaching teams. And what I saw crystal clear was that the emotional demands that leaders were facing were so much more extreme than they used to be. And I saw the strain that it was causing the leaders and teams that I was coaching. And what I came to realize is these shifts in the workplace really had fundamentally changed the role of leader and the amount of emotional skill that leaders needed in order to perform well in the modern workplace and maintain their well-being was really next level. And so together with my co-author, her name is Alicia Grandy, and she heads up Org Psych at Penn State, we just saw a real gap, a real need for an evidence-based book that provided really practical strategies to leaders for managing these new heightened demands and the additional emotional labor that was being required in their roles.
When I read your book, it just immediately flipped me back to a couple of, not a couple, like the vast majority of the executives that I coach. I can rattle it off, right? The executive who has been sent abroad and has three bosses who all disagree and is expected to deliver results, respect the culture and the organization, don't rock the boat, but make change. And not given a lot of support on that, and also moving his family at the same time to the other boss who is the biggest supporter of everyone on her team and making everyone better, but has no one above her playing that role or serving that for her.
Yeah.
And being told, you bring too much emotion into everything, and that's why you're not being promoted. So these themes come up all the time. Or the leader at a large firm. Everyone knows that he's talented, but man, he is causing chaos through these small signals in the way he leads meetings and organizations that is causing burnout, turnover.
Right.
And so you see this, and the work that we do as coaches, so much of it is around this part around emotions, navigating our own, navigating that, working with others. And so your book, and again, this part with both the science and the practical, what is the key message? Is there one that you really want people to take away from it?
Yeah, I think the overriding message is that emotions are information. They are data. So there are just so many myths and misconceptions about emotions in the workplace. And most of us, largely in the West, especially, like, we've been so educated, but only from like the neck up. And so emotions are this feel like this amorphous, even frightening thing to approach. But at the end of the day, like, what they are for all individuals, and especially for leaders, is information. So when we attend to our own emotions, we start tuning in and recognizing them, we make better career decisions, we have healthier relationships, we perform higher. And when you are a leader and you start to tune into and attend to the emotions that are resident on your teams, you unlock so much higher performance, more creativity, more engagement, a healthier team climate, and you retain your best people. So emotions are information. I had one client who became a total convert, and he said to me one day, he's like, Dina, he's like, emotions are money. And I was like, bingo, right?
Yeah.
They are. They totally transcend to the bottom line, but in ways that are indirect and hard to actually see.
Yeah. And that's why I deliberately in my lead talked about, hey, this is going to drive performance. The narrative of soft, the feminine side, the part that we should suppress. What your book has done is to say, hey, there's like a lot of hard stuff here that is going to translate, in the words of your client, it's money. And I'm going to add here also, for those out there listening, this is not only going to improve your leadership, but for those of you who are parents, humongous. We are dealing particularly now with social media, the stress and so forth of kids growing up, to say nothing of teenagers. There you're going to go into an interesting period. But yeah, this is a double gift to both your work life and to your family personal life. I can't say enough about that. I want to spend time talking about some of the science and the very practical section. There's more than a couple gems in there. I'll say first too, Dina, of the books that I've read, I pick one in particular, Why We Sleep, Matthew Walker. That one totally shifted the way I thought about sleep. And in a similar way, because of the evidence, and for those of you out there who are into data or geeks, want to see the evidence, because there is a lot of bad advice out there that is not evidence-based. Emotionally Charged does a very similar thing. And your first third of your book lays out the science that updates us. And that is my first question here, because you do lay out five myths. Is there one that you particularly, we're here in 2026 now, that you want to retire around emotions?
I want to retire them all. I mean,
there's the ambition. There's the ambition. Yeah.
But right. But if I had to pick, I think it would be this one because it's like the super umbrella myth, which is emotions get in the way of good business and decision making. Meanwhile, we know the opposite is true. When we don't acknowledge the emotions in our midst, they just drive behavior and decision making from the back seat. Mm. So I say welcome them in. Welcome them in, because then you know at least what you're dealing with.
So that first section of the book talks about those myths, lays out the evidence. And to break this down, I'm going to use some of my props here. I brought them. I don't have a beach ball. I saw the chapter title, Managing Beach Balls. And I'm like, oh, this is like another soft kumbaya type thing. But the analogy is really powerful. And I think people who are watching on video, I would have a bigger beach ball. But actually, I'm going to use this one. We're going to say that's a beach ball. But essentially, your idea is with emotions, they're like beach balls. And what most people do is they push them down. They suppress them. Like we're supposed to hide them, not bring them into work. And that beach ball analogy is interesting because if you push it down, the reaction is like it would pop back up. I brought this beach ball because that's historically mine, right? It was small. I was the stoic person. Okay, so we're going to toss that one. So beach balls are more like this. Our emotions are pretty big. So most people will suppress those emotions. Like these are things to ignore. Like we're rational and we should ignore that from work. Or you're told, right? I'm going to bring out my other prop here. Like the surface acting idea. Like we wear a mask. So I may be this, but hey, you got to show up in this meeting like this. Because you need to be seen as confident, which is competence. You need to do that. Hey, I need to fake it until I become it or am it. So there's the masking that goes on, or there's the other extreme. Oh, let's let it all hang out. I'm going to share everything. Like I got pigs at home, right? Or whatever that is. And I'm like, share everything about me, what is the appropriate way or balance that we should be thinking about this in emotions at work?
Okay. A lot to unpack there. Let me just start by defining emotional labor, because when you talk about this act of suppressing emotions that we really feel at work or evoking things that we don't feel, like being fake perky, this is emotional labor. Like we're doing this work either consciously or unconsciously to show up with the right emotions for a given situation at work. Because right, there are all these unwritten rules in the workplace about what the right emotions are, who gets to show them, and in what doses. So when we default to suppressing or faking because it feels as though the situation is calling for that, or we'd be safer choosing that, effectively what we're doing is, as you mentioned at the beginning, we're pushing what we genuinely feel under the surface. Now, sometimes that's absolutely the right approach, right? Like you also say, we can't just let it all hang out. That's really not a strategy either. But when we get into the habit of continually suppressing and faking how we feel, there's some very real cost to that. And that is because suppressing our emotions is like pushing a beach ball underwater, right? Like you can do it, but it takes effort. And you know life, right? Like you don't just get one difficult situation and that's your whole serving for, no, right? Like life is continually throwing you little difficult situations. And so instead of just pushing one beach ball underwater, now you're trying to submerge five or six. And inevitably what happens is they start to pop out and they pop out sideways, right? And they end up typically hitting some innocent bystander in the face or you, nothing good comes of it. And it sounds like such a silly metaphor. Like you said, you're like, this sounds like a silly chapter. But here's why. Because emotions actually have three parts. We talk about feelings and emotions as though they are interchangeable, but they're really not. So emotions have this behavioral component. This is what's on the surface. And when we are suppressing our emotions or evoking something we don't really feel, what we're dealing with is that behavior, like what others can see. But beneath the surface, every emotion has like a physiology to it. So if you think about the last time you were put on the spot in a high stakes meeting and you felt, right, we all have these different like tells, maybe you had butterflies in your stomach or your hands got clammy or that horrid like flush of heat to your face. That's the emotion, stress showing up in your body. It's not just showing up with you fidgeting on the conference room table, right? There's a physiological experience to an emotion. And then the third piece is there's a cognitive element. It's our interpretation or how we make sense of it all. And it's this piece that is probably most synonymous when we use the word feeling. I'm happy, I'm stressed, I'm envious, I'm brokenhearted, right? Whatever it might be. So when you surface act, you're really just dealing with the behavior. But these two other elements of the emotion, they've not gone away. They've not. And they're sitting there and they are waiting for you. And unless you do the work to process those or metabolize them, you can end up with these unintended consequences. Mm.
And so those three levels, the physiological, the cognitive, and the behavioral, a lot of your recommendations in the research here about the strategies, you can look and address and work on them. And you should be thinking about them as at those three levels, right? Mm-hmm. Things around breathing, journaling to reflect, your newsletter is a moment to think, and then the behavioral. So you actually think about maybe experimenting or doing certain things when that trigger hits. In all of that research that you went through, was there any research that was like, whoa, I didn't realize that? Anything that was surprising?
I mean, there was a lot that was surprising, but one thing that stood out to me really early on, it's sort of at the beginning when I realized like, oh my gosh, like the emotional labor of leadership has just, it's so heightened. And I started to dig into the research around that. And there's a study that was comparing the amount of emotional labor that leaders do to the amount that customer service folks do. So think the classic service with a smile, those kinds of professions. And what they found was that the amount was on, they were on par. That's so much emotional labor. And the thing about the emotional labor that leaders do is it is a lot more complex. It requires so much judgment, situation by situation by situation, versus having a script that you follow and this one very prescribed set of behaviors that you're expected to show up with. So the emotional labor that leaders do, it's especially toxic.
And I like a point that you brought out in the book. There is a section on the impact of technology. You make a really good point that, yeah, AI is coming. It is going to do administrative things. It is going to do analytical things.
Right.
And therefore, where humans still have the advantage is around the emotional thing. So we're actually going to be doing either more of it or that is going to be our expertise or what potentially remains. So that's going to become even more important. And you do talk about it as we need to upskill ourselves. Mm-hmm. And as we talk about the practical things that we can do, you talk about this idea of expanding our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that and why that's an initial bridge and building that opens up everything else in terms of management strategies?
Yeah, absolutely. When we have more emotion words, when we can become more granular with how we describe how we're feeling, we are all the more able to regulate those emotions. When we are limited to mad, sad, glad, we don't really get a deep understanding of what's going on. And when we don't have a deeper understanding of what's going on, we can end up taking misguided action. So for example, emotions that could feel somewhat similar, like envious and jealous, they're actually slightly different things, right? Or if you're just feeling down, well, that doesn't give you much idea of what to do about it. But when you can be like, I'm feeling down because I feel lonely, right? Then you're like, okay, well, this gives me guidance versus I feel down because I feel remorseful. That suggests a very different set of actions. And so when we can be more granular with our emotions, we understand ourselves much better. We can manage ourselves much better. We can communicate our needs much better. And we can take more guided actions that help us solve for what might need solving. It also, of course, gives us so much more insight into what other people might be experiencing. And so just by expanding your vocabulary, you open up this whole new world. Because if you don't have the word for something, I don't know, it's like if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, right? Like, is there sound? Like, if you don't have a word for something, can you experience it and do something about it?
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
And that is incredibly useful in terms of getting us to reflect on it, to talk about it. Not many people mm-hmm. do it. The reaction in our society today is you pop a pill. You know, you work with a lot of clients. You give a lot of examples also in the book. Is there one technique that you find is most helpful after you've got the vocabulary?
Yeah. I'll answer that in a second. But first, if anybody's intrigued by this whole idea of like more emotion words and they're like, where do I start? Literally, like you can on the internet get lists of emotion words or emotion wheels. There are apps. It's actually pretty fun when you start, or maybe I'm just like really geeky about emotions at this point, but like, I actually think it can be so much fun to expand your vocabulary and see the additional like nuance and data you can just squeeze out of something where you might have been like, I'm mad. Like, it's fun to be like, what kind of mad am I, right? Mm. Like, there's so many versions of mad. Mm. Anyhow, okay. To your question of if I had to choose from amongst my children, I think the one that comes to mind for me now, and I think it's because it's like, it's year end, like there's such pressure on business results. It's the holidays, everybody's emotions are heightened, is a framework that we offer around how to manage triggers in the moment. Mm. The framework is called Brave. And if we think about what happens when we get triggered, like oftentimes, especially if we're under-resourced, we have one of two failure modes. We either just shut down and don't say anything and like seethe and ruminate later, or we overreact and do something that we regret, say something we regret, I don't know, slam a door or whatever, mm-hmm. just like these things that we wish we hadn't done, right? Those are sort of the two things that happen often when we get triggered. And so the question is really, okay, what do we do in those moments that's like simple and easy to apply and is not just suppressing your emotions? That's where this Brave framework comes in. And these are simple science-based hacks for quickly deactivating. So B is for breathe. Our breath is the only physiological response in our body we can directly control. And it's like the keys to the magic kingdom. When you control your breath, you control your ability to bring your parasympathetic, your rest and digest nervous system back online and get out of fight or flight. So just by taking deeper, longer breaths, like such a simple first line of defense. R is for refocus. When we get triggered, we get hyper-focused on the thing that's driving us crazy. R is about just really expanding your awareness. So it might be on your internal sensations or Like, I have this lovely painting that sits in front of me and I can just like zen out on that. But it's about widening your perception. Again, it's mindful. It takes 3 seconds, but it's grounding. A is for accept. And that is just simply accepting your emotions as normal and valid given the situation. Our default is to push away. We feel like, I shouldn't feel that way. Why is he driving me so crazy still? Like, we invalidate our emotional experience. And that actually just turns the heat up higher. Versus just saying, it's normal that I feel this way. Doesn't mean you are going to roll over, but it brings the temperature down internally, which is what we're trying to do. V is for verbalize. When we seek words for how we feel, we bring our prefrontal cortex more online. So we dampen the activity in the amygdala and the emotional centers, and we go more into our executive function. So again, it is a quickly deactivating strategy. And E is for engage. Now that you've brought yourself back to a good place, like, you can move forward with a response versus a reaction. And that might sound like a lot, but honestly, you can run through breathing, refocusing, accepting, and finding a word in 20 seconds, 30 seconds. You just need to like get in some of the reps, and just using one of these strategies is better than none.
So. Mm-hmm. And what you said, so it's getting in the reps. It is practicing it. It is using it to develop that muscle, so to speak. That brave muscle. And that is the number one that comes up. I'm triggered by this individual, this situation. And a lot of times you know it's coming, right? You talk about anticipating that. There is the managing in the moment. And you talk a lot about, there's a whole section of the book of the importance of recovery, which we don't do as much. Anything you want to comment on recovery?
Yeah. So there are 3 ways that we go into detail about with the book, but I think if I were to call one out right now, it's this whole notion of restoration. And we purposely call it restoration versus self-care, because self-care, I think, is feels soft. You know, everyone thinks it's a bubble bath. It's not. What we're talking about is the fact that when you've been under some level of strain for a while, as all leaders have, there is a real physiological need to recuperate your resources. But we don't. We get stuck in this stress spiral, right? Where we just keep going and keep going. We power through. We burn the midnight oil. We grind. We do all these things as opposed to like taking just a little bit of time to put some energy back into the system. And I think it's misunderstood that we need to really engage in these like lengthy practices. But what we know from the research, again, there are really like 4 different experiences that can help us recover from the stress and emotional strain of leadership. And I'll run through those super quickly. One is detachment. Like, too often we quote unquote leave the office, but we're still working in our heads. We really need to take an actual break from thinking about work. And the second method is relaxing, whatever that means to you. Maybe it's a walk with a dog. Maybe it's like listening to your Spotify favorites. It can be any variety of things, anything that you find relaxes you. The third experience is mastery. These are hobbies, things unrelated to work that we're excited to learn and engage in. We don't need to just relax. Like, we can learn new languages, cook new recipes. Like, I'm an equestrian. I'm always like pushing myself to get better at that. That's a mastery experience. It has nothing to do with my day job. And then last but not least, having a sense of control. So for example, Michael, if your wife loves to hike, but your idea of like a restorative Sunday morning is staying in bed with like coffee and the paper, going on that hike is going to do her more good than you. And so choosing how we recover is a really important way of replenishing too, from just the drain of intense work.
Since you called out my wife, yeah, I mean, we are here in Europe and we always run up against this, call it a stereotype sometimes. She's like, oh, this is so American. It's like you're go, go, go work and you're not taking these moments, which they do better over here. But also, I think I would add to this point, like restorative doesn't necessarily mean taking off time and then just binging social media, right? That could actually probably do harm versus these restorative techniques that you've highlighted there.
Yeah.
These are important strategies that we can all use. There's the individual, what the individual can do, but also if your organization, the culture or the system is set up in a certain way, like there is no time off or you need to produce with no one on your team and no resources. I'm exaggerating, of course, but it's like you're fighting a system that is not structured to help you. What are some of the things that are, the onus is more on the company? Or, I mean, we could go all the way up to the level of society, but talk about beyond the individual level where companies or leaders can really make some big changes here that are going to help a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really difficult to create a lot of change when you've got so many headwinds at work. And that's in part why resetting the emotional climate and the emotional culture at work, like I really implore people at the top to understand the importance of that, not just to create a more human organization, but also because it unlocks resilience and performance within the system. I know that's the language at the top, right? Like you said, there's very hard evidence to support that. We know that there's more turnover, there's lack of organizational citizenship behaviors when people are unable to bring themselves to work. I worry about getting misquoted, right? Because I'm not, again, we're not talking about letting it all hang out.
Yeah.
Right? We all do need to manage ourselves and our emotions appropriately. But what I'm really trying to change the story on is the amount of suppression and faking that happens in organizations, because there is such a toll to the individuals as well as organizational outcomes when that becomes the de facto response that people need to take in those settings.
Mm. I always encourage people to think about where they have more power than they think they do. A lot of people out there are leading teams. They're not the CEO, but they may be at a level where, hey, I could change some of the dynamics on my team or how we do stuff. One example, a peer shifted to 55-minute meetings. So everyone has a five-minute break, to your point of restore, set up, take a little walk. Yeah. And anything else you would just encourage people like, hey, you might have more power than you think. And one thing that you could do that would get this going so that people can regulate or have time to start doing some of this emotional upskilling.
Yeah. I feel like most leaders actually underestimate the amount of power that they have in terms of changing things within their sphere of influence, right? Like it's so entirely possible. And if I were to just choose one thing for leaders to do, it would be normalizing emotional expression on their teams. So too often teams exist in this, I would call it like a narrow band of emotions. And it tends to be on the more positive sort of end of, call it this continuum, right? And that's because over time, we, beyond the myths and misconceptions, we've come to see that certain emotions are good and certain emotions are bad, which is incorrect. All emotions are information, but many teams are hovering in this more positive realm. And positive emotions are great, But when leaders allow for a fuller range of emotional expression on their teams, like allowing people to express their frustration or their stress or their overwhelm or their sadness, what we know is these teams, the ones where there's a fuller range of expression allowed and encouraged, they're more creative. They solve problems more effectively. They're more cohesive, resilient, and perform higher. Mm-hmm. Again, it starts like back to the power. Like it, again, it has to start with that leader, right? So that leader needs to take the onus upon themselves to start expanding that range, mm-hmm. and in inviting people in to name what's real. Mm. And so.
And being a model, to your point, to that example, I'm imagining, I can picture a couple of my clients, and I can picture people out there saying, yeah, that's great. We can share our emotions, but they're worried like, oh crap, this is going to turn into a bitching session, or someone's going to break down and then it's going to be like the gush that is going to like this contagion. Like there's a worry about that. A lot of what your book talks about is this is the Goldilocks, right? Striking the middle and mm-hmm. doing it just right. Is there a way to manage it so it doesn't get out of control, if it could get out of control? Like, how do you do that thoughtfully and purposefully?
Yeah.
going nuts.
Yeah. In part, we go back to that leader modeling, right? Like, the leader can't come in and gush. I'm not saying no tears ever, but we can't come in and just like gush. That's out of range. Mm. But it is the modeling. And we don't need to bare our soul or talk about our inner child. There is a range of appropriateness here. It's just the fact that like too often it's really stunted and there's more room to go. And honestly, some of these ideas that you just expressed, these are stories that leaders tell themselves, right? These are their fears. And they create avoidance. Meanwhile, if they really think about their teams, they're like, they're dealing with smart, rational, reasonable people who want to keep their jobs. By and large, they're not going to have people who go really out of bounds or gush or start raging around the office. The likelihood of that happening is so slim.
We had touched on this aspect of the power that people have. This is mm-hmm. my area, which I'm very passionate about helping people recognize their power. We've talked about good aspects of power. It can give you more autonomy, the ability to make change happen faster. You also bring up quite a few of the downsides. It can cause us to be overconfident, disconnected. If we're not aware, our emotions can just get magnified. Any tip there, because leaders also need to recognize that and manage that on an emotional side. Anything there that you would point out from your emotional, the work on emotions?
Well, yes. I it goes back to awareness of their power. Mm. So you've already mentioned emotional contagion, but there's another process by which emotions get conveyed. And whenever we have a power differential, the people with less power are attuning to the people with more power. So as a leader, regardless of how egalitarian you may think you are and how you show up, at the end of the day, you control the resources. You control who gets to keep a job, who gets promoted, who gets a bump in pay. You've got more power. Your people are trying constantly to read the tea leaves of your emotions. They are tuning in to what you say, what you don't say, how you react, the micro expressions. And so understanding just like, wow, it's a lot of responsibility. And so investing in your own emotional awareness and ability to regulate and keeping good hygiene such that you can authentically show up well, it's just so important, because the emotions that you show or don't show, they are getting amplified, like you already said, through emotional contagion. And then everybody around you, like you're constantly on a stage and they're trying to figure out like, is now a good time to go talk to Jane? Is now a good time to tell Bob about that bad thing that just happened with the project? Like everybody's trying to figure you out and is cueing their behavior off of you.
Very good advice. I'm glad that we captured that. Dina, fantastic conversation, fantastic book. Anything that you want to call out to make our interview here complete?
I would just offer an encouragement, which is emotion skills are learnable. Just like you've learned all sorts of things over the course of your career, emotion skills are an entirely learnable domain. So regardless of where you are on that learning trajectory, there's always more to learn. I wrote a book and I know I have a lot of learning to still do.
I would say that as well. There has been improvement, but it is a journey. My wife would be the first one to tell you that.
As would my husband.
You can improve. Dina, show notes will have links to you, your book, your work. And I know you have the Moment to Think as your LinkedIn newsletter. Many articles, but other ways that people would reach out to you, what's the best way?
Oh gosh, website, LinkedIn.
Okay.
You'll find me many places.
Dina Denham-Smith, executive coach, author of Emotionally Charged, How to Lead in the New World of Work. Dina, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.